Jeff Timmer is former executive director of the Michigan Republican Party. Mark Brewer is former chair of the Michigan Democrats. And this is a republic, if you can keep it, with Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer.
Welcome to A Republic If You Can Keep It. I'm Jeff Timmer, and later in the podcast, Mark Brewer and I will be joined by legendary Michigan political power broker Bob LeBrant. But first up, the politics of the week, and there's a lot of it again this week. Mark, why don't we start with the big news in Michigan, GM's $7 billion investment in electric vehicle production and technology here in the state.
Well, yeah, Jeff, there's nothing like jobs to bring the political parties together. I mean, we had, you know, at this announcement this week, we had the leader in the Senate, Mike Shirkey. Lord knows when the last time he actually appeared with the governor, and, you know, a wide variety of other folks as well. You know, again, it just seems like these kind of announcements bring people together. I got to tell you, I think GM was brilliant here. They leveraged the panic over Ford going to Tennessee into a real gold mine of corporate subsidies. I think if you add up the state money and the local money, you're talking about $1 billion in subsidies to General Motors to do these things. And now people are going to argue and debate about whether it was worth it. You know, there's long-term value to this. Is this a turning point for Michigan? But clearly, from a political perspective, everybody wanted to be there and share in the credit. And, you know, I think as this thing plays out, you know, there's going to be groundbreakings and there's going to be other things that will occur in the height of the campaign season. So it looks to me like a win-win all around for all the elected officials who are involved, you know, down to the township and city level.
Oh, no, I agree. And I think the optics are tremendous. And, you know, the you can the whole debate about government picking winners and losers, I think, takes a back seat to the public relations, the optics of Michigan retaining this critical investment. If GM had gone to Tennessee like Ford did, or gone to some other state, that would have been just a gut punch to Michigan in the auto manufacturing image, the heritage. When you look at where these manufacturers are all signaling they are going, electric vehicles will be the next century of American automobile production, and Michigan playing a leading role in that, as they have for the last century, putting down their marker here in the state very firmly that we're going to be the automobile powerhouse for the next century as well. And yeah, I think there's a lot of credit to go around. That credit will fall mainly to Governor Whitmer. I mean, there's just the legislators were, you know, dancing around this, but at the end of the day, they're term limited, and, you know, the legislative leaders and most of the folks involved and, you know, the press and the attention really don't give a shit about the legislators. The governor's going to get a lot of credit for this, and deservedly so. They pulled together a good deal. It will, everybody involved will be able to claim some amount of credit. She'll be able to claim the most and use it to her advantage.
Now, as it's noticeably absent from the announcement was the state senator from Eaton County, Tom Barrett, who I think he's running for Congress. So, you know, was that intentional? Was it not? But his absence was noticeable, you know, given everybody else who was there. I also think it was no accident that this announcement occurred 2 days before the state of the state, right? This is going to be a big deal in the state of the state. And we're going to, like you indicated, it redounds to the governor's benefit in so many ways. We're going to hear a lot about it over the next several months as the campaign unfolds.
Oh, absolutely. And mentioning the state of the state, that's a good segue here. The governor is expected in her state of the state address that she'll be delivering here shortly as we record this, talking about a repeal of Michigan's pension tax, which was a controversial tax enacted, I don't know what, decade-ish ago, and a repeal of that, which sounds politically popular, but the Republicans in the legislature don't want to give her a legislative win. Today in the Michigan Senate, they passed a $2.3 billion tax cut, a more general income tax cut. They're setting up this kabuki dance between the legislative Republicans and the Democratic governor. The Republicans wanting to keep control of the legislature and pick up the governor's office. The governor wanting to get reelected and get Democratic takeover of the legislative chambers. So no one wants to give the other side a win. What this probably means is this is a lot of PR, and there will be a lot of fodder for the campaign year, but probably, at least in my estimation, not a lot of actual policy progress.
Yeah, we'll have to see how it plays out, because I think both sides here now want to accuse the other, right, of being the tax raiser, or at least the, not the tax cutter. Right. It's always good to be on the side of the taxpayers in an election season. And there is, you know, a lot of money. I mean, revenue growth, budget growth has been extraordinary. There's still a lot of money that is basically sitting unspent in Lansing from the COVID relief packages that have been passed. And so there's a tremendous temptation to give some of that money back, but also to responsibility in the long run to make sure that in a few years, you don't wreck the state budget, right? That you don't recklessly do this. So I think you're right. There's going to be a lot of back and forth. There may be a win-win here. I may be a little more optimistic than you are, that maybe they can work out a deal, that there could be a tax cut that Republicans like, the governor could sign off on, and vice versa. So we'll have to see. But you're right. At a minimum, it's going to be a kabuki dance and lots of public relations. Maybe they can cut a deal. We'll just have to see how it all plays out.
Sure. Well, let's turn to what's become kind of the gift that keeps on giving here in our weekly podcast. Michigan Republican Party co-chair Meeshaun Maddick. You know, I've said for most of the last year, and I've been quoted in newspapers and other sources saying she and her husband, who is now a candidate for the Speaker of the House or Republican leader in the Michigan House, I've said that they're crazy, stupid, and mean. A couple of weeks ago, I added, looks like she's also a criminal engaged in election fraud, being one of the signatories on the fraudulent forged elector documents from the state of Michigan. And now this last week, she has got herself this weekend involved in again another self-generated controversy when she tweeted out a picture of Michigan Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist wearing a mask, you know, out in public, you know, during the pandemic, wearing a mask. He happens to be African American, and she said, you know, this is a face of the scary mask man. Keep your babies away. You know, it's clear. I mean, she's like I said, stupid, crazy, and mean, criminal perhaps, and clearly in my estimation, racist. And, you know, I've called this is reporters need to step up and do their job here. Republican candidates, Republican office holders, party officials need to be asked if they agree with her agree with her racism or renounce her racism. And there has been absolute silence so far. No one is being asked about this. She can't just be dismissed as some Yahoo. She's the co-chair of the Republican Party. She holds an official position of prominence. She's arguably the most powerful Republican in Michigan right now when it comes to endorsements, determining the outcome of primaries, convention battles, that, you know, what she says, what she does matters, and the party either embraces it or they don't. And it's something we need to know because, you know, she's like Marjorie Taylor Greene, but only half as smart. And she shouldn't be allowed to get away with this. And those Republicans in office shouldn't be allowed to get away with pretending they don't know what she's doing.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. You know, it's interesting that only former Attorney General Mike Cox came out very strongly to criticize her. But there's a lot of bad blood there because Maddock and Weiser replaced Laura Cox as Republican chair. That was an ugly fight about a year ago now. But it seems to me the Republican Party in Michigan is running out of people to be their face, right? I mean, after Ron Weiser called the three Democratic women leading the state witches and had that scandal involving his emails and other salacious activity at U of M, he disappeared. right? He's not been out there. He's not been called upon to be the public spokesman of the Republican Party. And that filled a manic. But now we see this, right? This open racism. I mean, it's like Lavora Barnes said the other day, it's hard to call it a dog whistle when your eardrums are exploding.
Right.
This isn't dog whistle stuff. This is blatant racism. There's no other explanation for it. And you're right, Jeff. They either replace her or, you know, shove her aside because right now she is the Republican Party in Michigan. And everything she has done, what may be criminal activity relating to last year's the 2020 election, her embrace of Trump, and now this, that is the Republican Party in Michigan these days.
Well, I'm going to read the tea leaves here. She's not an outlier. This is not an extremist. This is not somebody who's outside the norm and mainstream of the Republican Party today. What she has said, what she has done, from her abhorrent comments of her criminal activity and lunacy about the election, her freaky worship of Trump, her racism, that is today the Republican Party in Michigan. And I am going to say that she's not going anywhere. She's only going somewhere if she wants to. There's no one in the party with the power or the balls to take her on. No one will dare fight her. I mean, yeah, great, Mike Cox. I respect him coming out and saying he's never a guy to shy away from a fight or calling it as he sees it. But he is the only Republican that I've seen say, even make eye contact with the fact that she's said this and done this. The rest of them are going to sit silently by because they're either in agreement with her or they're chicken shits afraid to take her on.
Right. I mean, you know, her husband is obviously aiming to be Speaker of the House next time. She's got this close relationship with Trump. I mean, there's an enormous amount of power there. She's going to be a power broker, I think, in the next couple of months as we get up to the Republican endorsement convention as well. And so you're absolutely right. Nobody is willing to take her on because they don't want to offend her and they think they need her political support.
Mark and Jeff are joined by legendary Republican power broker Bob LeBrant. After these messages on A Republic If You Can Keep It.
Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm with nearly four decades of experience accurately measuring public opinion about politics, ballot proposals, and other federal, state, and local issues. Epic MRA is one of the most quoted polling firms in the country. Clients include media outlets, school districts, colleges and universities, state agencies, local governments, labor unions, interest groups, and businesses throughout Michigan. Whether it's measuring voter opinion about who's up or down in elections, or if ballot proposals or legislation can earn voter approval, Epic MRA is known as the go-to Michigan pollster. Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
Show your support for preserving our republic at the A Republic If You Can Keep It merch store. We've got t-shirts and coffee mugs made to order for lovers of our representative democracy. Just go to our website, arepublicpodcast.com, and click on the merch store button. You aren't fully dressed until you have Ben Franklin on your chest. It's the perfect gift for that democracy lover in your life.
Joining us this week is a legendary figure in Michigan politics with whom I've tangled for many years. Bob LeBrant served the Michigan Chamber of Commerce for 34 years, heading its political and legal programs. He is known nationally for his help in organizing corporate association and chamber political action committees. LeBrant has been active in the redistricting process over the last four decades, ever since he arrived in Michigan in the late 70s. He was the primary architect of Operation Red Map, the successful 2010 effort to take control of redistricting in Michigan by winning control of the Michigan legislature. As a result of his efforts, Republicans were able to gerrymander the state to maintain control of the legislature and congressional delegation for most of the last decade.
Throughout his career, LeBrant aggressively pursued campaign finance legislation, Department of State rulings, campaign finance complaints, and political litigation. And as a longtime friend of Bob's, I can say that even his most ardent opponents, including Mark over the years, respects Bob for both his incredible political talent and his impeccable integrity. His role in the 2010 Michigan gerrymander is part of his excellent book, As Am I, Pac-Man, a memoir, a revealing look at the real world of contemporary Michigan politics. Welcome my longtime mentor and friend, Bob LeBrant. Bob, thanks for joining Mark and I. And I just want to note before we get into our conversation here, it's rare that the three of us talk without the presence of a court-appointed stenographer.
Or a lawyer, or many lawyers. Yeah, welcome, Bob. With your decades of expertise in the campaign finance law, tax laws, and so forth, you're the ideal person to talk to about this growing scandal around former Speaker Chatfield. So we wanted to, plumb your knowledge and talk about all the things that could flow from this. I guess I'll just kick it off first. Apparently Chatfield had this Peninsula Fund, a 501c4, which raised apparently millions of dollars over the time he was in office. It was controlled by his staff, but according to one press report, apparently never had a board meeting, and one board member didn't even know the thing existed until it was dissolved. And, money flowed for a wide variety of things to benefit Chatfield. So Jeff and I'd welcome your thoughts on the C4 and what issues may come up out of that.
Well, before I discuss the Peninsula Fund and the abuse of 501c4s, I thought that this quotation from Bill Nolan probably summed it all up. He said, term limits, 30-year-olds running political caucuses, balkanization of political ideology, mindset of a lobbying corps that thinks that you can't spend enough, what could go wrong? I think that epitomizes this whole situation. Mark and Jeff, recently I was interviewed by, Detroit, Cranes Detroit, and I indicated that, you could have predicted this, back in 1994, when the legislature decided to abolish office holder expense funds. I testified before the House Oversight Committee that at the time was co-chaired by Frank Fitzgerald, and Pat Gagliardi. And I told that committee that legislators were going to want to have another bite at the fundraising apple. And you were going to take it from a regulated, reportable expense fund and just drive legislators into creating their own 527 administrative funds, which actually would be reportable, or into 501c4s, which would not disclose the identity of the contributors. And or they would, try to potentially create, 501c3s, which are much more regulated and probably not well adapted to this unless you wanted to just give out scholarships. But what we have with 501c4s, when you read recent news reports, they were using this for a variety of reasons, travel, food and beverage. Mark, you and I have filed complaints about the misuse of 501c4s in ballot question campaigns. And so, this is an area that requires, proactive regulation to clean up these abuses.
Yeah. So let's pursue that. So 501c4s are supposed to be in the pursuit of social welfare. It's not social welfare to pay for one person's travel and entertainment, apparently, and food, et cetera, as he lives like a king while he's speaker. So there's a problem there of private inurement, right? A misuse of these funds.
I would agree. I think there's a great personal tax liability that the ex-speaker faces as time goes on.
I want to hear him explain how stuffing dollar bills into the G-string of a stripper meets the social welfare requirement.
Yeah, I mean, this has been, this has been widely abused for a long time. I used to tell my friends at Sterling, what in fact is the social welfare purpose of this 501c4? I mean, besides running issue ads, which I think are legal given the language and in the campaign finance law, that you have to have express advocacy. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you're in compliance with being a social welfare organization. So if you want to spend 100% of your money on issue ads, I think you run afoul of the IRS code. The same thing, applies to those 501c4s that want to basically contribute all of their money to a ballot question committee. What's the social welfare purpose in making, all of these contributions to a ballot question committee that's been formed to pursue some sort of, a political or partisan aim? I would hope that this would give the legislature the opportunity to revisit some of their missteps, since 1994. And kind of clean up this mess.
Yeah, that 1994 change, as you remember, Bob, was in reaction to a House scandal back then, right?
I think it was mainly because the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press couldn't help themselves. And every time they got a copy of an officeholder expense fund report, they just went down and saw all of the season tickets that got purchased for every professional sports team or major college team under the sun. And so they would run articles ad nauseum on, legislators who bought Red Wing tickets or Piston tickets, or I suppose a few bought Lions tickets, maybe Michigan Panther tickets way back
when. Yeah, the Lions tickets could be considered a charitable donation.
So this fund, I mean, there's all kinds of things here, because apparently from these reports, it wasn't just Chatfield who benefited, that there were a number of legislators who went on these trips with him, right? So there may be some liability there.
Well, there's a lot of potential violations, Mark, I think, under the Michigan lobby law.
Yes.
If, in fact, first of all, I'm sure that the Peninsula Fund did not register as a lobbyist or a lobbyist agent under the lobby law. But, that hasn't stopped attorney generals in the past from looking at people who said, hey, I'm not a lobbyist. I'm into public relations. But I'm up to my eyebrows basically in getting people to vote yes or no on a particular bill.
Right. I mean, it seems to me this thing was just improperly run just from the get-go as a corporation, right? We had his two top staffers were on the board, a third person from Alpena, I think, who was on the board, but apparently never attended meetings, didn't know the thing was operating. So it wasn't even operating properly under Michigan corporation law, let alone all the other issues that we have now touched on. Yeah, it's a real mess.
I think that poor drain commissioner, I think he's running for the state house. At least I thought I heard him mentioned as a possible candidate for the state house.
As I remind my clients all the time, if you're on a board, you have fiduciary duties. And it doesn't sound like he adhered to his very well. Why don't we move over then and talk about these four PACs that Chatfield set up, obviously, among other things, to maximize his ability to make contributions. Four PACs that, by last count, raised $5.2 million while he was speaker. I think there's all kinds of potential there too, in terms of those PACs are supposed to be used to help elect people, not to finance trips around the country and lobbying. And there's even been hints of something approaching bribery.
At least as far as leadership PACs are concerned, they can accept unlimited contributions from individuals or from political action committees. The one virtue of leadership PACs, I suppose, while we're discussing this, is at least the contributors are somehow itemized on these campaign finance reports, unlike 501c4s that basically are hidden from any kind of public view.
Right, but I think with that kind of money, basically, Chatfield bought a lot of allies, right? People who were probably not going to blow the whistle on him, at least while he was speaker, because they were so beholden to him. They'd gotten so much money and support for their own elections. So it was a way to insulate himself from anybody, at least at that time, going after him. It's just amazing to see that much money in four different PACs being controlled by one person.
Yeah. I mean, having been on the inside of moving caucus money around for decades and knowing how the committees work, how the leadership offices have worked, how the campaign culture and the connection between consulting firms and leaders work, the amount of money that was going from these Chatfield controlled committees, whether it's the PACs, whether it's the C4, his 527, whatever it is, to the business that's controlled by his two top staffers. That kind of nepotism is extraordinary. I mean, it's inside baseball on steroids, and the sums involved. It's just, there are, you know, this is nothing more than rumors at this point. The investigations could uncover something, I guess, that is nefarious. But when you have, you know, seven figures going to one firm, it's hard to, for many people to imagine that Lee Chatfield is just, you know, being altruistic here and making the Menards rich out of the goodness of his heart and not the greed of his wallet. And so that's another place that he could potentially be, have exposure if he has any connection, silent, partner in any of these companies or funds, if he's the personal beneficiary of any of these reportable funds that are going through this company. And, you know, that at this point is all speculation, but hell, you know, we're a podcast. We can speculate all we want.
My observation is that it's not unusual to have legislative staffers somehow be involved politically. Okay. Now, I in the old days, there used to be some bright lines that, you know, if you did this sort of stuff, you did it on vacation time, or you did it, on weekends or after business hours or something like that. Now, the idea that policy and politics are intertwined isn't necessarily all that new. At the same time, I've never heard of a situation where a chief of staff to the speaker gets to run their own political consulting firm, on the side. That seems to me to be, just over the top. I remember a few years ago you had, scandals when legislative caucuses over in Wisconsin were found to be involved in political campaigns. One speaker, I think, had to resign over in Wisconsin. They've had scandals in Ohio, and why Michigan would somehow be immune, is something that I think needs to be examined closely.
You had mentioned the Michigan lobby laws, and correct me if I'm wrong, but historically, the chief of staff to a caucus has been a lobbyable individual. And if a corporations, if PACs, if associations are giving unlimited sums to a independent committee, to a caucus committee, to anything, and that money is then going into the chief of staff pocket around lobbying laws. I mean, that's an enormous scandal here that people could. The contributors could be unwitting participants in, or witting. We don't know. But the potential for fallout in the damage that it could cause in the contribution world of corporations and associations is enormous.
Well, I'm not so sure that Rob Menard was listed as a lobbyable public official. Because that determination as to who, in fact, is a lobbyable public official is pretty much up to that legislator, him or herself. That's an area that probably would need tightening under the lobby law. But guess what? that legislation would probably be dead on arrival unless this scandal further accelerates.
You know, it is just hard to believe that given the scale of the Menards business, that they weren't using house resources, paid time, computers, office space to run their business.
I think when I heard about that, Mark, it seemed to me that there needs to be an investigation about a violation of Section 57 of the campaign finance law. And that deals basically with public bodies. And I think the House Republican caucus and the House Republican the House of Representatives, would fall under the scope of Section 57 of the campaign finance law.
Oh, yes. Now, I filed complaints about the legislative bodies. And I think, Bob, you're kind of segueing into here what we all know, which is that the leader in the Senate and the speaker in the House basically control an enormous budget without any internal or external accountability. And while this hasn't been explored yet, I think it's entirely possible, given what we've seen, that people couldn't keep their hands out of these money pots, that there may have been some misuse of House funds in addition to everything else we've seen so far.
Well, and that was alluded to by Chatfield's brother in the Bridge magazine article that interviewed he and the sister-in-law, who are kind of at the epicenter of the sex and statutory rape scandal. And so, allegation of misuse of public funds came from a direct source named Chatfield. And so, there's no other evidence of that, but certainly the misuse of taxpayer funded staff positions could definitely fall under, that category.
Right. And there was a letter within the last 36 hours from the Chatfield sister-in-law, the accuser here, her lawyer, to, I think, the Speaker Wentworth, demanding that there be an internal investigation of all of this, because that's another unexplored area. I mean, Wentworth was a mentee, basically, of Chatfield, right? He was Speaker Pro Tem while Chatfield was Speaker, part of the Chatfield team. And so I think you got to ask whether there's a cover-up going on inside the Republican caucus in the House, because they're fearful of the fallout.
They were premature in dismissing that they were going to do an internal investigation. I think they said that because the state police were looking into it, they didn't feel that they needed to. Well, an internal investigation is the one that at least knows where perhaps where all the bodies are buried.
In talking about close relationships, you mentioned Chatfield grooming, and maybe that's the poor choice of terms here when you consider Chatfield, but his kind of choosing Wentworth as his successor. Chatfield was the chosen groom successor of Tom Leonard, the former speaker, who was the failed Republican nominee for attorney general in 2018, is trying to again get that nomination. In the just ginormous sums of money going from his accounts to Chatfield's accounts and Chatfield's accounts back to Leonard's accounts. I mean, we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars moving back and forth between these two. And that when I've mentioned collateral damage, right now you have to assume, at least for the time being, that that at least it puts a real dark cloud over Tom Leonard's bid for attorney general, the top law enforcement officer in the state, if he is potentially ensnared in this financial scandal that could be involving not just campaign funds, but these social welfare tax exempt nonprofit funds and possibly public funds. And so until the investigation is complete, I don't know how the Republicans could dare nominate somebody like him that could be caught up in this growing scandal that's going to be playing out through this election year. There's no way this is going to be resolved before the Republicans have their endorsement convention at the end of April. I mean, maybe not before they have their nominating convention at the end of August.
I mean, I can say that. I mean, the hypocrisy here to me, as I recall, the Republican caucus in the House didn't waste any time going after Corser and Gamrat with an investigation. There were committee hearings. You know, they were unpopular in their caucus, from what I am told. But, you know, prompt public investigation and discipline of them. Here, silence, attempting to use the state police investigation as an excuse not to do an investigation. You know, the hypocrisy, the double standard here, I think is appalling. There's another aspect of this that hasn't been talked about much, and I want to ask folks about it. You know, there's his father's church, which is a 501c3, and obviously is supposed to have a charitable mission. And so for the now, I think there have been press reports of prior allegations of sexual misconduct against people connected with the church. So it's not just this allegation against Chatfield now in a church run by his father, but other allegations are coming forward too. So it seems this could have ramifications for that church as well. Agree, disagree?
No, that's an interesting angle. And I guess I would throw with the church and also the church run school and some of these reports and some of the articles in the Detroit News and the Free Press and Bridge Magazine, there's mention of Lee Chatfield, that students at the school were conscripted into participating in his campaigns. And that would seem, even though it's a private school, that would also seem to be a violation that wouldn't be allowed to force students as a requirement of attending that school to participate in a political partisan campaign. That would seem to have implications as well.
The one thing about 501c3s differing from 501c4s or sixes or whatever is that there is an absolute prohibition about involvement with political candidates. And so if, in fact, you've provided, if the school has provided kind of an in-kind contribution to someone's, you know, campaign by enlisting these students to, I suppose, go door to door or do whatever, stuff envelopes or whatever, that seems to me to be an in-kind contribution of some sort. And another potential reason for the church itself, perhaps, to lose its tax exempt status. I mean, I think their real exposure is their failure to report to the appropriate agencies, you know, allegations of impermissible conduct. I thought Bridge Magazine, you know, did a story about a second victim. And that second victim was talking about, a teacher other than Lee Chatfield. It was, I don't know if we got to the stage of statutory rape with this girl, but certainly there was physical contact. I guess I haven't read all of the salacious articles, but they got some explaining to do, I'll tell you that.
Right. I mean, that affects their tax status, as you indicate, Bob, and penalties and the worth, but there could be enormous civil liability.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, lawsuits brought, you know, for the reasons you indicated, you know, failure to supervise. Maybe people knew about the conduct and allowed it to continue.
This one girl, I think, was on some mission to South Texas when the unlawful touching occurred, at least.
Yeah, well, listeners may not know, especially those outside of Michigan, but many inside Michigan, Speaker Chatfield's father, who is the pastor at the church who runs the school, is also over the last few years very personally involved in Michigan politics and was one of the lead organizers of many of the COVID protest rallies at the Capitol that led many of the public fights against the COVID mitigation efforts. And so this is not an innocent bystander in all this. This is a active political player, apparently using his C3 status in questionable ways.
Yeah, you're right. All the political involvement and everything else, as Bob indicated, could be a real point of vulnerability for the church and its members and, folks who knew what, who's running the church, et cetera, just like we talked about with the board of the C4.
There's a lot going on.
Well, Bob, thank you so much for sharing your historical knowledge, your expertise, your experience in these matters. It sounds like you were prescient back in 1994. It took a while for your prediction to come true, and probably has happened before this, but now it's public. And we'll see how this all plays out.
Well, Mark, thank you and Jeff for inviting me to participate with you folks today.
Well, Bob, I'm sure it's warmer where you are than it is here, because it's about, I think, a high of 7 degrees today. So it's
yeah, we're in the high 40s, but it's nowhere near what it is back home in Michigan.
Well, thank you for joining us. And that's a wrap for this week's podcast. Our thanks to our friend Bob LeBrant for joining the discussion.
And thanks to all of you for joining us again this week. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, send us an email, comments@arepublicpodcast.com.
If the Republic is still standing, we'll be back next week. I'm Jeff Timmer.
And I'm Mark Brewer. See you all next week.
You can subscribe to A Republic if you can keep it on your favorite podcast app. A Republic if you can keep it is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.